Okay, I'll call the Employee Benefits Programs Committee to order. And I would ask Jen, if you please take the roll.
Thank you. Representatives LaFleur.
Here.
Doctor.
Here.
Kreit. Lanning.
Here.
Mitskog. Owens. Ruby.
Here.
Senators Dever.
Here.
Beckedahl.
Here.
Krebsbaum.
Present.
Larson.
Present.
Lee.
Present.
And Mather.
Aye.
Great. Mr. Chairman, we do have a quorum this morning.
Thank you. Okay, I do want to welcome, see Representative Kreit is not here, but he's replacing Representative Boehning. Representative Matt Ruby is replacing Representative Striley. And Senator Mathern is replacing Senator Nelson. So welcome. What we're doing today is part of the responsibilities of this committee is to take jurisdiction of potential legislation that affects PERS, TFFR, and the like. And we have about 13 statutory, this is a statutory committee as opposed to an interim committee, which means that we can meet during the session and so forth if needed. So with that, I guess I would, the minutes of our October 25th and 26th meeting are online. And are there any questions or is there a motion or any discussion?
I move to approve, Mr. Chairman.
Motion by Representative Lanning to approve. Is there a second? Second by Senator Beckedahl. Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any discussion? And that's just a... Okay, we'll do a voice vote on that then. All in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carries. Okay, just a couple comments that I have is that the three bills that are in front of us, or bill drafts, I should say, the committee did take jurisdiction over in the last, in our last meeting. They were submitted late in the game, so we have already taken jurisdiction. We're going to listen to a couple of reports in regard to those bills today and determine whether or not to give it a favorable rating, an unfavorable rating, or no rating. And what the legislation can still be brought forward no matter what we do to it, but our rating will be, our recommendation, I should say, our recommendation will be attached to the bill as it moves through the legislative process. So again, our job today is to take a look at these bill drafts, listen to these reports, and then at the end make a favorable, unfavorable, or no recommendation on each one of these three bill drafts. Are there any questions before we get going? Okay. Then what we will do, we'll have the presentations and then we will go through the bill drafts one by one. And I would ask now Faye Kopp if you could come up and give us a report on the Teachers Fund for Retirement. And she did pass out some documentation just a couple of minutes ago.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Faye Kopp. I'm Deputy Director for the Retirement and Investment Office, which is the agency that administers the Teachers Fund for Retirement. As a follow-up to your October Legislative Committee meeting, there were a couple of requests for information. The first sheet that I handed out is called the TFFR Fast Facts. If you recall, at the last meeting, you did receive a presentation from TFFR's actuary regarding the funded status of the plan and projections of future funding levels in the future. This is not intended to be a repeat of that very extensive presentation, but really is just some reference information for you, giving you a snapshot of some of the issues that were discussed at that October meeting. So that's just a piece of information, and on the back side of that is a plan summary, because again, there were some questions that related to plan benefit provisions, so we wanted to have that in front of you should you need that information. Now the actual question that came up that we do have additional actuarial information for you is in a letter that I handed out from Siegel Company dated November 30th of 2018. If you recall at the last meeting, the actuaries provided information related to what the funding of the plan would be should active member population remain stable or flat, which is what is which is what is standard in the actuarial presentations that are given. The committee asked what will happen if active membership population increases, in that DPI and others have projected student growth to be anticipated in the years ahead. So I did work with staff from DPI, and we came up with how that student population growth might turn into active teacher growth in the future. And what we came up with as far as a projection or a guesstimate is potentially 1% increase in active member population growth for the next 10 years and then flat after that for TFFR funding projections. Okay, so what we provided for you then is information in this letter that says if active member population increased 1% per year for the next 10 years, what would its impact be on TFFR funding levels? If you look at the projections in Exhibit A, which is the third page of this, Exhibit A shows the blue line on the top shows active membership population. And this is what was presented to you last month at your meeting, showing that if TFFR active member population in 2018 was 10,881 members, if that remained constant, and if retired members increased in the years as they are anticipated to do, because of, you know, people living longer and more people retiring, we had anticipated that there would be retirees would increase the number of active members by about 2036. And that's what that top chart shows. The bottom chart says, well, wonder if there's an increase in active member population growth. And again, the blue line shows if active member population went from 10,881, 1% per year, which is about 100 teachers or more per year, up to 12,000 teachers within 10 years, and then remain flat after that, you can see that the red line, which is the number of retired members, would not ever exceed, at least in this 30-year period of time, retired members would not exceed the number of active members, should that happen. As far as what that would translate into as far as funding, if we did have active member population growth, would TFFR become 100% funded sooner than we had anticipated? Under current projections, we anticipate that we would be fully funded in about 2043. If we would see an active member population growth such as what was presented here, we would see that happen about 2 years sooner. TFFR funding levels would reach 100% funding in about 2041. Or about 2 years sooner than under current projections. So that's basically what this letter from the actuary was designed to answer that particular question. So yes, active membership population would help TFFR plan funding. Would it make a huge dramatic difference? No. But it certainly would help. It's a positive. Active membership population growth is certainly positive on the plan. Do you have any questions?
Thank you, Ms. Kopp. I guess I do have a question. That you, the 1% growth, what is that assumption based on? I mean, I think if memory serves, that it's growing at a much faster rate than that, is it not? Or
okay. What we have seen and what DPI has seen in the last 10 years shows about a 1.3 or 1.4% active member population growth in TFFR members. Okay, so while student population may be growing faster, obviously, you know, how that translates into active teacher growth is a little bit different. So historically, through the oil boom and everything that's been happening in the state, we've seen it grow at about 1.3 for the last 5 years, 1.4 over the last 10 years percent. In working with DPI and as they're projecting things into the future, we agreed that 1% would be a reasonable expectation in the future, at least for the next 10 years.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions of Ms. Kopp? You're getting off easy.
Thank you.
Good job. Thanks. Oh, go ahead, Senator Larson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, when I was, we were discussing about the retirement average of a 5 year, it used to be 3 year, they would average the last 3 year salaries. Will we need a legislative a bill draft for if we decide to change that to a 10-year ratio?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Larson, yes, in order for TFFR to calculate that change in plan provisions, similar to any other plan provision changes, we would receive a bill draft. It would be incorporated into a plan provision change in a bill draft. Once that bill draft was presented to the committee and accepted for jurisdiction, then we would turn it over to our actuaries and have them run the numbers.
And as a reminder, if that were to come to be, it'd have to go through this committee again, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Any other questions?
I have a question.
Mr. Larson?
I'm not so sure that has to go through this committee. It probably would make it easier to pass if it went through this committee, but anybody can put forward a bill
mm-hmm.
during the legislative session, yeah.
Go ahead, Jen.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I can't speak to the procedure that is actually followed, but I can tell you that statutorily there's a requirement that bills that affect the retirement system need to go through this committee in order to be introduced. If something's amended during session in a way that would affect it, those amendments, as the law is written, would also need to go through this committee, and that's one reason why this committee is so active, continues to be active during the legislative session.
Okay, any other questions? Discussion? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Can I make one comment?
Sure, Jen.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I will work with Faye to get an electronic version of the presentation she just gave. So we will link that to the agenda. I will try to get that. Is Faye still here? Are we able to get that today yet?
Yes.
Okay, we'll have that link today, so you'll be able to review the information that she just provided, and then we'll also link it in our minutes when we do that.
Okay. All right, then we will ask Mr. Scott Miller to step forward. He's going to give us a report on the status of the PERS retirement system, and then the defined contribution versus benefits.
Yes, good
Welcome.
Morning.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I'm going to hand out... This is what we give folks, non-classified employees who are eligible for the defined contribution plan. This is what we give them as far as some information for to help them make the decision on whether to elect the defined contribution plan. So as you mentioned, I'll be talking a little bit about defined contribution versus defined benefit. Short update on PERS. As you know, we had 5 bills in front of this committee. A technical corrections bill, a change to how our final average salary is calculated, and then 3 bills that are that we introduced in order to try to get us back in the path of full funding: a contribution increase, a multiplier reduction, and the end of retiree health insurance credit for new employees. The PERS board at its last meeting met and decided to submit all 5 of those bills, and so I will be submitting those to the Legislative Assembly coming up, and so we're going to hopefully get on the path back to full funding here very shortly. So we're looking forward to that. As far as my next thing, the defined contribution, defined benefit discussion, you have the electronic version of that. I gave you an electronic version rather than print because actually for the next presentation when we talk about the bills, the tables are so small that you might need to magnify them on your screen. You're certainly not going to be able to see them here, and on paper it's even difficult.
They are linked to the agenda.
Thank you. So I was asked to give just a brief background on and some information on defined benefit versus defined contribution plans. I've been, as you may recall from, well, some of you are new, I've been in the public pension industry for about 20 years, 20 and a half almost. It'll be 21 in January. And so I've worked a lot. I was here. I was the attorney for PERS for 8.5 years from 1998 until 2006. I was here and helped implement the defined contribution plan when that was first implemented here. Most recently, before this position, which I began in May, I was the retirement program administrator for the City of Phoenix Employees Retirement System. We actually implemented 2 new hybrid plans down there. A hybrid plan is a hybrid of a defined benefit and a defined contribution plan. So I have an awful lot of experience working with defined benefit plans and defined contribution plans. And so I drew on some of that experience and some studies that are out there, informational studies from a number of national organizations to try to help put together some of the main similarities, and not a lot of similarities, differences, contrasts between defined benefit plans and defined contribution plans. So I'll start with defined benefit plans. Defined benefit plans are exactly what their title says. they provide a defined benefit for a member. Employees are entitled to a defined benefit that is determined by a formula, typically the formula that you see on the screen. The benefit is the service, the member's service, times the final average salary, times some multiplier. So the service is the years employed. Final average salary is usually an average of their last 3 years, their last 5 years. You just heard Senator Larson talk about last 10 years. So that's really depends on each system. Each system's a little bit different. And then a multiplier. The multiplier is usually between 1% and 2% of pay, sometimes higher. For public safety systems, which typically do not participate in Social Security, that can be a little bit higher than that 2% from time to time. And so what you do is you take that, so say you had 10 years of service, and your final average salary was $10,000, and you had a multiplier of 2%, you would get $20,000 per year going forward. So you get 20% of that salary, or of that 2 times 10 years, so 20% of that final average salary. So that's 2,000, not 10,000. So that's how that benefit is determined. Benefits are pre-funded. That's one of the most important things about the system that we administer and other public entities around the country administer. We pre-fund these benefits with contributions by the employer, the employee, or both. And how those contributions are determined is through actuarial analyses. The actuaries come in, they do an experience study, we'll talk about that shortly. They do an experience study to determine which actuarial assumptions are the best for our population. And they use that to determine what that contribution should be in order to make sure that we're pre-funding, that we're contributing enough to pay for those benefits going forward. And the benefit under a defined benefit plan is defined again. It's payable for that member's lifetime and typically has both a disability retirement component and an option for continuing payments to a survivor, because you can do that with an actuarial reduction. Typically, the benefit that you see, the service times final average salary times multiplier, typically is a single life annuity. Some places have that different. Actually, the public safety retirement system in Arizona, their main retirement, what you would get from that is 100% joint survivor with their spouse, which is part of the reason they're having such trouble with their financing. But you can take that single life annuity that you would get under this, and you can apply an actuarial reduction to it to take into account the different lifespans of yourself and your spouse in order to get 100% joint survivor or a 50% joint survivor. So we have a lot of things that we can do with that final benefit just by applying actuarial reductions to them. Getting to the actuarial assumptions, we look at mortality as one of the biggest. You know, how long is somebody going to live going forward? Because what happens when we determine that benefit is, when we determine how much, when the actuary determines how much contributions are necessary, they project benefits for absolutely everyone and then bring that back to a present value to see how much we have to pay in order to get that value in the future. So that mortality, how long a person is going to live, is very important. The assumed rate of return is very important. When we bring those monies in, as they're contributed, they're invested. We have the State Investment Board that does an excellent job for us that invests those monies for the long term. As a matter of fact, nearly 70% of a member's benefit is paid for by the investment earnings themselves. Less than 30%, or about 30% is paid from the employer and the employee contribution, but almost 70% is from just those investments, and so that's a very important part of this. Another actuarial assumption is a salary increase, longevity within the system, retirement rates, that type of thing. And as I mentioned, they're determined through an experience study that's done every 5 years. Under statute right now, it's done every 5 years, and that's a best practice that most retirement systems across the country use. The oversight of a defined benefit fund is, and its administration is usually done by a board of trustees. There are a couple of single trustees out there. North Carolina has a single trustee. I believe New York has one. New York City has a single trustee. But typically, they're a board of trustees. And those trustees have a fiduciary responsibility to ask to act in the best interest of the members and beneficiaries of the fund. And those fiduciary responsibilities include the duty of prudence, the duty of loyalty, and the duty of care. You might hear a lot of other little fiduciary responsibilities. They all primarily relate to those three, however. The investment of a defined benefit trust fund is typically done by investment professionals. Again, we have the State Investment Board. I don't know if you saw the release the other day, but Mr. Dave Hunter, the director, is one of the top five most well-recognized investment professionals in the country for public pension systems. He's been doing a great job for us. But because we, or the state, the trustee is doing all of that investing, all the investment risk is on us, is on the plan sponsor, not the employee. That's one of the biggest differences between a defined contribution and a defined benefit plan. Defined contribution, that investment risk is all on the member. With a defined benefit plan, it's all on the plan sponsor, in this case, the state. The good thing is that those pooled investments from everyone's contributions into a big pool usually result in lower fees. Usually when number one, we have access to institutional investor investment options that you and I as individuals would not have access to. But the more money that we invest with them, the lower fees that we can get. They typically have step fee levels where if you have $100 million invested with them, it might be 25 basis points. If you have $500 million invested with them, it might be 10 basis points. And because we pool all those investments, sometimes you can get those lower fees. And finally, the structure and the operation of the plans are subject to strict Internal Revenue Code requirements. There are any number of things within 401A of the Internal Revenue Code and the regulations that have been promulgated thereunder that apply to public safety or to public retirement systems. Some of the ERISA requirements are there as well. ERISA doesn't directly apply to public pension systems, although we do look to ERISA requirements as persuasive in the absence of kind of an equivalent requirement within public pension requirements in the Internal Revenue Code. So as you apply all of those different thoughts to the NDPERS defined benefit plan, first off, please understand that we're actually a hybrid plan because of the portability enhancement provision that you guys passed back in 1999. That portability enhancement provision allows employees to vest in a portion of the employer contribution if they make contributions to the 457 deferred compensation plan. That's not typical in a defined benefit plan, in a public defined benefit plan anyway. Usually the employee only has access to the employee funds, and usually only when they terminate. If somebody terminates and doesn't want to wait for a benefit, they can take out their employer contribution, like in a DC plan. But in our case, they also get access to some of that employer contribution if they participate in the PEP plan. And so we have a hybrid plan that has some aspects of the defined contribution plan within it. Our benefit formula is very similar to the one that I showed you before. The only difference, our multiplier is 2%. We moved that up pretty much through the 90s from the low 1% range up to 2% because of the investment gains that we received in the 1990s. The average monthly benefit right now as of June 30th, 2018, our actuarial valuation was $1,220 a month. And keep in mind, that's payable to people for their entire lives. And so that's a decent benefit going forward. The contributions that we currently have are 7% for employee, 7.12% for employer. And as you recall, we're asking that to go up. We need that to go up another percent each for employee and employer in order to try to get us back on the path to full funding. The North Dakota PERS Board is the board of trustees that oversees our system, oversees the administration, the operations of our office. They have all of those fiduciary responsibilities that we talked about before. As I mentioned, the State Investment Board invests the trust funds on our behalf. They've gotten us an 8.33% return over the past 5 years. That's an excellent return from my perspective, especially since our assumed rate of return is 7.75%. So we've had some nice actuarial gains over the past 5 years because of that. And finally, the Internal Revenue Service issued the North Dakota PERS plan a qualification letter stating that we comply with all Internal Revenue Code requirements. That's a very helpful thing to have for, especially for investing purposes, but also assures you and assures the members that we're operating as a qualified plan to maintain the tax-deferred status of the plan. This is you can see on the screen, a map of the state of North Dakota. This is all of the benefit, I'm sorry.
Senator Lee.
Mr. Chairman and Scott, what's the length of time for vesting?
Vesting is 3 years.
3 years for a full contribution? For a benefit, I mean?
Yes. And up on the screen, you can see all the payments that we make every year across the state. This is as of 2017. We make over 145, almost $146 $1 million of payments out of our defined benefit plan to every county within the state. Burleigh County gets about almost $48 million, Grand Forks County, 13, Cass County, almost $20 million. Every year comes out of the defined benefit plan payable to retirees that reside in each of those counties, each of your counties, helping the economic engine flow within those counties. Out of state, we pay about $23 million for a grand total of nearly $169 million a year that we pay out. That's one of the biggest payrolls in the state. Now on to defined contribution plans. DC plans is what I'll call them. They're similar to 401ks. What they guarantee is a specific or defined contribution to a member, to their account. Contributions are typically from both the employer and the employee, combination of both. Some places only have employee contributions. Some have only employer. Members immediately vest in their contributions and usually vest in the employer contributions over time. A DC plan member is not entitled to a specific benefit. The only thing that they're entitled to is a specific contribution. Their benefit is the account balance that they have when they retire. A DC plan member is usually responsible for setting the investment asset allocation for their account. It's kind of a newer trend to have an institutional investor do that for people. That doesn't happen very frequently. Those investments are typically in mutual funds, which tend to be a higher cost than institutional type investments. Again, the state investment board can get access to lower fees than a general person can through a mutual fund. DC plans are also typically overseen by a board of trustees. DC plan members, however, are subject to the following risks that DB plan members, so defined contribution plan members have these risks that defined benefit plan members do not. General market risk, or the risk that their investments will perform consistently with the overall financial markets. Sophistication risk, or the risk that the individual may not have the financial or investment knowledge and experience in order to adequately invest their funds. Longevity risk, the risk of outliving their retirement benefits. Studies show that DC plans are typically only about half as efficient in providing benefits as a DB plan for the following reasons. Defined benefit plans can pool the longevity risk, or the risk that somebody's going to outlive their retirement assets. That usually improves efficiency about 10%. Defined benefit plans have optimal asset allocations. They have professionals investing their monies in an optimal asset allocation manner. That results in about an 11% improvement. Defined benefit plans typically have cost savings due to higher returns and lower fees of all types, which improves efficiency by about 27%. As a result, with the same contribution rates, DC plans may only provide 50 to 60% of the benefit that a DB plan can provide for the same contribution rate. Thus, if you want to give an equivalent benefit to a DB plan, contribution rates into a DC plan would need to be higher. Now about the North Dakota defined contribution plan. Our current contribution rates are 7% for the employee and 7.12% for the employer, the same as the defined benefit plan. Members vest in the contribution over 4 years. They vest in 25% per year over that 4-year period. The North Dakota PERS Board also oversees our DC plan within the state. And the board has hired TIAA as the third party administrator for the defined contribution plan. The DC plan has numerous and highly diversified investment options for DC plan members, including a brokerage window that people can go through and access just about any investment that they want to. The DC plan is currently only open for non-classified state employees. From 2013 to 2017, it was open to all new employees, and about 3% of new employees elected to join. Right now, as of September 30th, 2018, we have 108 active members in the defined contribution plan. And that is it for my comparison of the two types of plans. Is there anything else anyone would like to know?
Senator Mather.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Please refresh me. It seems to me we permitted defined contribution enrollees to go back to benefits?
Yes.
That still in place, or was that just a one-time deal?
That was a one-time election for current defined contribution plans to come back into the defined benefit plan. They actually pay 2% more in contribution because of the difference. About 75% of the DC plan members took that option and moved back over to the DB plan.
Thank you. Mr. Miller, could you go to slide 7, I believe it was, or on that particular page, it talks about improving efficiencies through a defined contribution versus benefit. I'm sorry, the other way around. If you have a defined contribution plan, can't those efficiencies be the same in terms of pooling the resources and things like that? What am I missing here? That where you talk about higher returns and lower fees, improve efficiencies by 27%, can't that be done in a typical defined contribution arena, or what am I missing?
Well, that's where there are a few entities out there now that are, instead of allowing the DC participants themselves to invest the money, they are actually depositing it in something like the State Investment Board and having an institutional investor invest them on their behalf. That helps with that particular part of it because you're getting access to a better asset allocation. You're getting access to institutional investments with lower fees. And typically, overall, it's lower fees in that regard. And so you can affect that one. I haven't seen data on how much of that efficiency you regain when you do that. But there are very few entities out there that are doing that right now. It's kind of one of the new things to try to help. I mean, folks who have DC plans are realizing that they're not as efficient, and so they're trying to identify ways to make them more efficient, and that's one thing that they're trying.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Then we will go through the bill drafts, and you are going to address these as well, Mr. Miller.
I am.
So, Jen, did you have any comments before?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, if you want, I can review the bill drafts.
Please do.
Okay, I will. We've got three of them before us. I think if we follow what we've done in the past, we'll do them each individually. We'll do them one at a time.
Right.
Having noted that 382 and 383 are nearly identical, there is a very important substantive difference between them. 382 provides for closure of our PERS main plan for new state hires. As you recall from our evaluation report done at our last meeting, that plan also has political subdivisions in it. This first one would just close it for state employees. It would keep the ones that are in there today, would keep them in there. It would be for new hires that they would then go over to defined contribution instead of defined benefit. We would allow the political subs to continue to enter new employees into that plan. And then we would use, we've got an unfunded liability for that plan in order to make, and that unfunded liability calculation will change when we change the assumptions made. So if we close that plan, we're going to change the assumptions. So we can't just go straight back to what we heard at our last meeting and say our unfunded liability is this amount, no, $1.3 billion. It's going to change as we change our assumptions. What this bill draft provides is that we would use principal from the legacy fund. We would make biennial contributions from the principal of the legacy fund until it reaches 95% funding. The second bill draft, I know I just said we're going to do them one at a time, but I want you to know the difference between them as we go into them so you can expect it. 383 does the same thing, except it closes that plan entirely. It closes it for new state employee hires, and it also closes it for political subs.
Okay. Go through bill draft 382, please.
Say, well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Scott Miller, Executive Director of PERS. I will say this has been, I've been in this industry almost 21 years. This, and I'm pretty good with the actuarial stuff. This has been one of the most complex actuarial studies that I've ever seen. We had to make a number of assumptions in order to be able to provide you with the studies for these bills. As Jen mentioned, one of the And as I mentioned kind of earlier, one of the biggest actuarial assumptions that we have to make is our assumed rate of return. Well, when you close a plan down, you have to reduce the risk that you have in your investments for that plan. Because if you close that plan down and aren't projected to be receiving new monies from new employees, and you gradually scale that down to zero, you have to put it on what's called a glide path. You have to put its investments on a glide path and gradually de-risk the investments of the plan. Because if the plan were to close, 30 years from now, we wouldn't be able to weather a great recession like we did. Whereas if it remains open, we're long-term investors. As long as the plan remains open, we're long-term investors. We have an infinite horizon, essentially. We're not ever planning for the state of North Dakota to go away. And so we can have a more aggressive asset allocation, recognizing that sometimes we're going to hit a bump and sometimes we're going to hit a peak. And that's what we take into account when we make those. And so we had to estimate, okay, what assumed rate of return will we have over the course of time if we close this plan down? Well, right now we have a little bit of experience. We have the job service plan. We administer the job service plan. It's a closed plan. There are only 7 active members left in it. The rest of them are retirees. And just this summer, it was kind of helpful for me to start in May, because just this summer we had to reduce the risk again in that system, or for the investments of that system, moved it down to 20% bond or 20% equities and 80% bonds. And as soon as we did that, the actuary said, well, you got to reduce the assumed rate of return as well, because you're not going to get the same. We moved that down to 4.7%. And what happens when you move a discount rate or assumed rate of return down, you have to move that discount rate down. That discount rate, if you remember from my discussion last month and the month before, you use that discount rate to discount those projected benefits from the future back to a present value to make sure that you have enough money to see how much contributions you need, make sure you have enough money to pay all those benefits. Well, when you reduce that discount rate, it actually makes the liabilities go way up. And so moving down to a 4.7% rate from the 5.5% that we were at before made those liabilities go up, but we had enough money in the system to be able to do that. Well, in this case, we're running short. We're 72% funded, but over the course of time, we'd still need to reduce that asset allocation and de-risk those investments. And so we had to decide, okay, what's the best way to do that? And so we had the actuary model both a 6.5% discount rate and a 5.5% discount rate, because we don't know what the average is going to be over the course of time, probably somewhere in between 5.5% and 6.5%. And so you'll see in the materials that you have a projection for both a 6.5% and a 5.5% discount rate. We also had to figure out, okay, how many people do we think are going to take the option to go into the defined contribution plan? In the early 2000s, when the DC plan was first opened, nearly 38% of the eligible employees took it, moved into the DC plan. On the other hand, from 2013 to 2017, when it was opened to all new employees, only 3% took it. So, you know, we have a pretty disparate number there. So we had the actuary, again, model two different scenarios, one in which 10% of employees who were eligible moved over to the DC plan, and another in which 30% moved over into the DC plan. And then kind of there are a lot of moving parts to this. And then the final thing is well, what happens with that $108 million transfer from the legacy fund? Well, there's a possibility that that if these bills are introduced, they don't get the two-thirds majority needed in order for us to get that money at all, but they still have a majority vote, which makes everything else go into effect. And that would mean we close the DB plan with no extra funding. There's also the possibility that we only get that, even if we get the two-thirds majority, that we only get that $108 million a year for 2 years, because nobody's taken money out of it. Nobody's taken principal out of it before, and so nobody knows if this legislative assembly can burden that fund going forward. And then, of course, there's a possibility that we do get the $108 million every year until we hit 95% funding. So we had our actuary model all three of those. And so you have the three of those models, no legacy funds, legacy fund for 2 years, legacy fund for as long as we need it. Then you have the other two scenarios as far as 10% of employees take the DC plan and 30% take the DC plan. And then you have the two different discount rates, 6.5% and 5.5%. And you can see, even for somebody who's been in this for 21 years, that is an awful lot of different things to take care of. We just got the final reports on Friday at about 10:30 at night. And so that's how long it took our actuaries to try to get all that information together. This isn't going to be the most clear presentation that I've ever given you, and I'm going to apologize for that. But I'm also going to ask you not to shoot the messenger, because it's also going to be one of the most grim presentations that I give you. I assume there are going to be a lot of questions. I will do my very best to answer them. I'm reasonably good at actuarial things, but there are some things we may need to talk to our actuary about if you ask too detailed of questions. With all of that as a background, we'll go forward. Bill 382, as Jen said, is to close the defined benefit plan to new state employees only. That allows political subdivision employees to keep moving forward. It transfers $108 million a year from the legacy fund principal into the NDPERS fund until it is 95% funded. It closes the defined benefit plan to new state employees, not political subdivision employees, after December 31, 2019. Only state employees would go into the defined contribution plan. It does not apply to judges, National Guard, or public safety members. The reason I say that is because right now, all those retirements are all in one trust fund. Under the statute right now, we have one trust fund for all of those entities. And as you'll see in a little bit, that actually tends to be a little bit more problematic than you might think. Bill 382 also allows current state defined benefit plan members to elect to transfer into the DC plan. The amount transferred would be the actuarial present value of benefits or the employee and employer contributions plus interest. DC members vest 100% in the employer contribution after 1 year. As I mentioned in my previous presentation, right now they vest 25% each year for 4 years. Here are some of the administrative notes, and we took quite some time going through these bills to try to help you understand exactly what these bills would be doing. First, that uncertainty that I talked about regarding whether North Dakota PERS fund will receive any legacy fund monies or will continue to do so after the current biennium. The accelerated defined contribution employer contribution vesting, so that vesting in the employer contribution to the DC plan, where it's now 100% vested after 1 year instead of vested over time over 4 years, that reduces a funding source for us for a defined contribution administration. Right now, we use the forfeitures to help fund the administrative costs of the DC plan. The forced liquidation of investment assets to fund the transfer amounts to the defined contribution plan. So again, current DB plan members have the option to go into the DC plan. The forced liquidation of those investment assets that the State Investment Board is investing on our behalf may decrease the returns and affect our asset allocation. There's also an actuarial loss for every defined benefit to defined contribution transfer that happens. Right now, they take with them 100% of their accrued benefit, but we're only funded at 72%. So they'll be taking an extra 28% of their accrued benefit with them that we don't have funding for. So we'll take an actuarial hit with every single person that moves over to the defined contribution plan. The bill would also require us to administratively and actuarially separate the state defined benefit plan members from the political subdivision defined benefit plan members. Because if you recall, we're supposed to get that legacy fund contribution until we reach 95% funding. Now, our actuarial consultant notes. The main PERS system is currently projected to become insolvent in 2106. You heard that at the last meeting from the actuary. Under this bill, it gets worse. The main PERS system will become insolvent between 2048 and 2074, depending on the scenario. Now, this next part is what's kind of tough. Notably, because we're all in the same trust fund, once the main PERS system becomes insolvent, because the trust fund is not statutorily divided, we'll continue to pay benefits. They'll be paid out and eventually drain the entire trust fund for political subdivisions, public safety employees, and for judges until it goes down to zero. The The asset allocation will need to be gradually de-risked, resulting in a lower expected rate of return going forward. We talked about that they're modeling two different discount rates. We'll have a lower projected investment return and lower future contributions because of the absence of new employees. That results in the earlier depletion of assets. That additional $108 million contribution doesn't do anything for that, except prolong it. This is the one that's hard to see, and I apologize, but you can see all the scenarios that we have right there. The second column shows the investment return assumption. So line one is the baseline. That's our 7.75% assumed rate of return. Lines two through six are the scenario where there's a 5.5% investment return. And then seven through 11 are the 6.5%. And then you see scenario A, where we receive no legacy fund monies. B, we get it for 2 years. C, we receive legacy fund monies until 95% funded. Scenario D is 10% of employees go to the defined contribution plan, and the legacy monies continue until we're 95% funded. And E is 30% of defined benefit plan employees go to the DC fund. It's a little hard to see on here, but it's a little easier to see on this graph. That line up at the top is our current funding level, where you see we gradually go down until we are completely depleted in 2106. Under none of the other scenarios do we make it anywhere close to that far, to that time frame. Under the worst, we are depleted in 2046, I believe, 2048, and start taking monies away from political subs and judges and public safety officers until they're completely gone as well. The total main system assets are depleted in that case in 2048. So it doesn't look good. This is the 5.5% assumed rate of return. This is the 6.5% assumed rate of return. You see the little peaks on those three to the right. That's when the main PERS system for state employees hits 95% funded, and that $108 million goes away. And then we gradually decline until we don't have any money left at all. So that is, unfortunately, the message for 3082.
Well, thank you for cheering us up.
Yes. You know, the teachers
got real quiet.
The Teachers Fund for Retirement Board, when I was their attorney, called me the Grim Reaper. So,
okay, thank you. Are there any questions of Mr. Miller in regard to Bill Draft 382 or any committee discussion? Senator Beckedahl.
Hey, Mr. Chairman Scott. I know this is specific to these bill drafts, but in the presentations this morning, will you bring a number that could fund a 95%? Versus $108 million? I mean, in other words, in the models, did they ever put a number in there that would get us to where the plan is today by doing these things in 382 and 383?
Well, we get to 95% funded in several different ways. The problem is, or in several different scenarios. The problem is once that $108 million gets shut off, we're not getting enough contributions or investment income in to sustain the plan, and we crash back down to zero.
I guess my question is there a number other than $108 million that would make a difference in that? And was that provided to you by the consultants?
The $108 million was in the bill itself. We did not receive, well, there wouldn't be a number because once we hit that 95% funded and it goes away, I mean, even if we got $300 million a year until we hit that 95% funded, it's still going to drop.
So the issue is when it's no longer funded. It's not the issue of how much is put in.
Correct.
When it's no longer funded. Okay.
Right. Because you can see we're still going up, at least in those three scenarios, we're still going up until that $108 million gets shut off.
Any other questions? Senator Dever.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Scott, when we talk about state employees or state employees plus political subdivisions, I think it's important to recognize, and I asked the Attorney General several years ago, regarding TFFR, who is ultimately responsible for that? And his short response was, school districts are creatures of the state. So if the political subdivisions go broke, that is a liability ultimately on the state.
agree, Senator Dever, that once we hit zero, then we come to you folks every biennium for enough money to pay off the retirement benefits. We become a pay-as-you-go system instead of a pre-funded system. And that $160-some million that I showed you on the map of North Dakota, we need that from you every year.
Senator Mather.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Scott, who's the author of Bill 382?
Representative Steiner out of Dickinson. That brings up an interesting point. City of Dickinson is actually going to be joining our defined benefit plan on January 1st. They're going to bring a few hundred employees with them. They're very concerned about the bill. We talked with them the other day, and they're very concerned because obviously if it gets closed down as soon as they join, it's not.
I just want to make a comment about Representative Steiner. She's having surgery today, and that's why she is not here. Otherwise, she most definitely wanted to be here. So, Senator Larson?
Mr. Chairman, are there any states now on a pay-as-you-go discussing?
To my knowledge, not, although Kentucky retirement system is very close. I believe they're only 10% funded. But the point of a defined benefit plan is to pre-fund. Otherwise, we're like Social Security, essentially. Social Security is a pay-as-you-go.
Any other questions? Okay, committee discussion. We have three potential motions. One is to give this a favorable recommendation, an unfavorable recommendation, or no recommendation, so that if Representative Steiner moves forward with this legislation, it would be attached to the bill. Comments? Is there a motion? Or Representative Craig?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move an unfavorable recommendation with regards to this bill. Too many ifs.
Unfavorable?
Unfavorable, okay. Yes.
There's a motion, is there a second?
When you're looking at using money out of the legacy fund, you know, you might have a session where you're going to get 2/3 of the vote to go forward to take the principal out. Next session, you might have a change in members of the legislature. They would not give the 2/3 votes. So there's just too many unknowns here. And just to let you know my personal feelings about the legacy fund, I think we're premature in looking at taking principal out of that fund at this time. I think the vote of the people when this measure was passed, the intent was that this is a rainy day fund for the future. Well, I don't think this is the future yet. If this initiated measure would have never been passed, the money that is now in the legacy fund, which is earning, you know, sufficient income, would not be there because this almost $6 billion would have been spent over the years. We wouldn't have it. But at least now we've got that amount of money in principle, and we're using the earnings. It's starting to do what I think it is meant to been do, but I don't, at this point, tapping into the principle of that fund would defeat the whole purpose as far as I'm concerned. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. There's a motion. Is there a second?
Second, Mr. Chairman.
Second by Representative Laney. Okay, before I call on committee discussion or vote, is there anyone in the audience that would like to address the committee prior to us voting on this? Anyone in the audience would like to comment? Okay, we have a motion before us. Is there any committee discussion? Okay, so the motion is to, if you vote yes, you're supporting the motion for an unfavorable recommendation. If you vote no, obviously you're voting against that recommendation of unfavorable. Okay. Jen, if you call the roll, please.
Thank you. Representatives LaFleur?
Yes.
Doctor?
Yes.
Kreit?
Yes.
Lanning?
Yes.
Mitzcock?
Yes.
Owens? Ruby?
Yes.
Senators Dever?
Yes.
Beckedahl?
Yes.
Krebsbaugh?
Aye.
Larson?
No.
Lee?
Aye.
And Mather?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman, the motion does carry.
Okay, so the unfavorable recommendation will be attached to Bill Draft 382. Okay, let's go on to Bill Draft 383. Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill 383 closes the defined benefit plan to all new employees, both political subdivisions and state employees. Again, it would transfer that $108 million a year from the legacy fund principal until we're 95% funded. Closes DB plan effective December 31st, 2019. All new state employees would go into the defined contribution plan. The defined contribution plan, and this is actually another complexity that we ran into. The defined contribution plan currently does not allow political subdivision employees to go into it, and this bill does not address that. And so we had to have our actuary model this without any political subdivision employees going into the DC plan. So new employees of political subdivisions just wouldn't have access to a state plan. If the political subs wanted a retirement plan, they would need to create one for themselves. And then we also modeled it in the event that the bill gets changed to allow political subdivision employees to go into the defined contribution plan. That would give them, those new employees, access to an established retirement plan, and that would probably be better for them going forward. Again, this does not apply to judges, National Guard, or public safety members. Allows current state DB plan members to elect to transfer into the DC plan. The transfer is the greater of, again, actuarial present value benefits or the employee and employer contributions plus interest. Then the DC members vest 100% in the employer contribution after 1 year instead of that 25% per year over 4 years. Similar administrative notes, uncertainty over whether the ND PERS fund will receive any legacy fund monies or continue to do so after the current biennium. That accelerated defined contribution employer contribution vesting reduces that funding source. Again, we use those forfeitures to help fund our administrative costs for administering that DC plan. That forced liquidation of investment assets to transfer between the DB plan and the DC plan may decrease our returns and affect our asset allocation. Over 300 political subdivisions would lose access to an established retirement plan unless this bill is changed to allow access to the DC plan for their new members going forward. And then again, the actuarial loss for every defined benefit member that transfers over into the defined contribution plan going forward. And in this one, I put down a question as to whether doing so creates litigation risk, because again, every time somebody transfers over, say an entire political subdivision decides they want all of their employees all decide to go to the DC plan, well, that takes more money out of the defined benefit plan trust than is really allocated to them, which affects the funding for all the other systems and all the other employees out there. So I wanted to bring that forward. From a consultant perspective, GRS, our actuary, has very similar, very bad news. The main PERS system is currently projected to become insolvent in 2106. Under this bill, the system will become insolvent between 2043 and 2076, depending on the scenario. The insolvency is between 2043 and 2078, so potentially 2 years later, with political subdivision access to the DC plan and that DC plan election. And again, notably, once the main PERS system becomes insolvent, because the trust fund is one trust fund, we'll continue to pay monies out of there and very quickly deplete all the assets, including the ones that we would use to pay for judges and public safety. Asset allocation, again, will need to be de-risked, resulting in a lower expected rate of return. We had the model of 6.5 and 5.5 again for this bill. Lower projected investment return and lower future contributions result in the depletion of assets that additional $108 million infusion is insufficient to replace. Here you can see that graph again, showing the different scenarios vertically and then horizontally what the impact of those are. The third from the right column says provides you the year the assets are depleted for the main system. That's for the entire system. Currently you see 2106. That released would be 2043 if we get no legacy fund monies, and we have a 5.5% assumed rate of return going forward up to the 2076 down at the bottom. And this, importantly, is for no political subdivision access to the DC. We have another table for political subs having access to the defined contribution plan. Here's what this graph looks like with 5.5% assumed rate of return, a very sharp decline in almost every case. And this is with 6.5%. You can see it going a little higher, almost a little over 80% funded. And then we crash back down to zero before 2080. These are the stats for if political subdivisions are granted access to the DC plan and are able to make that election. Under 5.5% assumed rate of return, a very similar result. 6.5 is a little bit different. In that one scenario, the very top scenario, you see 30%, that is where we get the $108 million until we get to 95% funded, so a continuing appropriation of that fund. And then 30% of eligible DB plan members elect to transfer into the DC plan. I was a little surprised at that. I expected the more people that went into the DC plan, the worse off we would be. But we get to 95% funded, I can even see it, 2060. And then again, to get to your point, Senator Beckedahl, once that spigot gets shut off, once we hit that 95% funding, it's not enough. And we plunge back to the ground and run out of money. 2078. So that is, again, my wonderful news for Bill 383. Again, kind of grim. It's very difficult to close a defined benefit plan when it's severely underfunded as we are.
Any questions of Scott or Mr. Miller, I'm sorry. Senator Dever.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Scott, I don't think I heard you say it, and I think I got it from the information, but what would be the immediate unfunded liability if we made the decision to find contributions? And it seems to me that doing the math, I came up with $3.5 billion.
Thank you, Senator Dever, and Chairman Senator Dever. When I was just doing a back of the envelope calculation in my head, I figured it would go up to $2.5 to $3 billion, and it's just depending on the scenario, it's just a bit north of that. The problem is there are so many variables that we had to model that number is different for every single one of those scenarios that the actuary modeled, and so it really depends on which model we're looking at. But the important point is we deplete all the money in the trust fund far quicker than we are right now, even if we don't do anything and never get to 100% funding and run out in 2106.
Refresh my memory also. If we stay with the DB plan and do the one-on-one, at what point do we achieve 100% funding?
Under the actuarial calculations, and we make all of our actuarial assumptions, I believe that was 2057. That we become 100% funded.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, anyone from the audience like to address the committee? Anyone from the audience? Senator Anderson, come on up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure I'm a member of the public, but I am a member of the audience. My question would be similar.
Could you give us your name for the record, please?
Howard Anderson, Senator from District 8.
Thank you.
My question is, under the current plan that we have, the defined benefit plan, I haven't heard any actuarial numbers on how much total dollars we would have to add to the current plan to make that fully funded, or how we say we could afford $50 million a year for a certain period of time, how many years that would take to make the current plan fully funded and wouldn't have to change things. And I've been kind of looking for that number. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, right now we are just under $1.1 billion underfunded. That is the amount that we would need to fully fund all the benefit obligations going forward. that number, plus all the assets that we have on hand, plus all the assets that we anticipate gaining in the future through future contributions to the plan, would be enough to pay off all the present value of liabilities that we have, that our actuaries determined right now. So that answer is $1.1 billion.
Thank you.
As far as a yearly amount that would go forward, that we would need, I mean, our actuary would have to do that calculation. We'd need to have an anticipated end date. I mean, if we wanted to get fully funded by 2030, how much would that take? Some of those parameters in order to sure. have them come up with that number.
Thank you. Senator Lee.
Mr. Chairman and Scott, just maybe a comment. Isn't it about the risk you want to tolerate in terms of being unfunded? We could fund it all today, and tomorrow the stock market may fall down, and we're back to 95% or 90 or so. Isn't it the risk you want to bear in terms of unfunded liability?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lee, it depends on what your objective is. It's not a horrible thing to be underfunded. It's not a horrible thing to be overfunded. You're not guaranteed anything by being overfunded, and you're not prohibited anything by being underfunded. The important part is whether you're on a trajectory to get back to 100% funding. The problem that we have, and one thing I should have, in hindsight, should have put in the presentation that I finished over the weekend, if you recall our conversation last month, or in October, when we talked about the actuarial evaluation, because we're not ever projected to get to 100% funding, the Governmental Accounting Standards Board requires that we use what's called a single discount rate in order to determine our liabilities for reporting purposes. That single discount rate that we have to use is around 6.32, 6.34% for reporting purposes. It's not for funding purposes, it's for reporting purposes. Using that single discount rate increases our liabilities by about $600 million. The other thing that GASB requires is that every single employer that is in our fund has to report their portion of that unfunded liability that we have to do under that single discount rate under the GASB, because again, that's the GASB funding number. That's the part that political subdivisions are having a difficult time with right now, because this past year was the first time that they had to report those numbers, and their liabilities went through the roof. Their financial statements look horrible right now, and so we're getting questions from political subdivisions about what happened. How come our liabilities went up? And we have to point to GASB and say, well, this is what's happened. Your liabilities have gone up. That's affecting the state's CAFR as well. All the employers, including the state, all the political subdivisions, have to put that number down on their books that we provide them. That becomes difficult from a bonding perspective. When you're upside down in your financial reports, your rating isn't going to be as high as if you're flush with cash. And so under all of these scenarios that we've shown you, we're never projected to get to that 100%. And in fact, we're projected to get to zero faster, so that single discount rate goes down and those reportable liabilities go up. But on the other hand, if we get on a trajectory to get back to 100% funding at some point, that single discount rate goes away. And we just report based on liabilities that are determined using our assumed rate of return as the discount rate, or that 7.75% assumed rate of return that we have for a discount rate. That results in that $1.1 billion in liabilities, which is still a lot of money, but it's a lot less than $1.7 billion. So it's not a bad thing. It's that trajectory that's really important for reporting purposes. But it's also not a bad thing to be 80% funded, 90% funded, 95% funded. As long as that trajectory is going up, we're fine. If it starts going down, that's where things become very problematic. And even though we have about 72% funded level, TFFR is below 70%. But they're on a trajectory going up, and so they're better off than we are right now. Even though it looks like our funding is better, but their trajectory is going up, and so they're in a much better financial place than we are. So there are a lot of different moving parts to that.
Any other discussion or questions? Is there a motion? Representative Craig.
Mr. Chairman, I will make the same motion as I did on the last bill, giving it a unfavorable recommendation without any further speeches. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Kreit has moved an unfavorable recommendation. Is there a second? Second by Senator Mathern. Okay, we have a motion before us. Any further discussion? Okay, hearing none, I'll ask Jennifer to take the roll, please.
Thank you. Again, just like last time, a yes vote would be in favor, an unfavorable recommendation. Representatives LaFleur?
Yes.
Doctor?
Yes.
Kreit?
Yes.
Lanning?
Yes.
Nutskog?
Yes.
Ruby?
Yes.
Senators Dever?
Yes.
Becquedal?
Aye.
Krebsbaum?
Aye.
Larson?
No.
Lee?
Aye.
And Mather?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman, that motion carries as well.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dever.
Mr. Chairman, in my recollection, I think we have a package of bills that came from PERS, and I think these are the only two bills that came from a legislator. I think it would be appropriate that the entire package go through the first chamber together before the next chamber. I know typically it goes through the chamber of the chairman.
Well, as it should.
But since these two bills are sponsored by a House member, and the reason I say that is I think it's time for us to make a decision, either to stay with defined benefits or to change to defined contributions. And I think considering the entire package in its totality assists in making that decision.
Jennifer, you want to comment on that?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, in a typical legislative committee, the default is that the bill drafts would be introduced in the chamber of our chairman, unless there's a directive otherwise. I need to bring to your attention that in this case, we did have several bill drafts that were recommended by legislators, so we don't just have our agency bill drafts. We've got several that are legislator-sponsored, so they will go to the whatever chamber of that legislative sponsor. Another thing to keep in mind is these agency bills, as we look at where, as we work with leadership and where to assign them, it's quite common that we would assign them in the House that has their appropriation so that they go through that way. So there are several factors to keep in mind. Leadership will be making these decisions as far as where to put them, and I would encourage you to work with leadership to get the agency bills in the chamber that you desire.
Mr. Chairman, I don't disagree with that. My primary concern is that they go as a package, so that they're together. And my recollection is the legislator-sponsored bills had more to do with health insurance than with pension plans. Maybe I'm missing something.
I don't recall.
Duly noted. We'll discuss that with leadership. Okay, Bill Draft 388. Jennifer, if you want to start describing that a little bit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're changing gears here, as Senator Dever kind of walked us into that. This one's not dealing with our retirement plan. What it's dealing with is our health insurance benefits, our uniform group insurance. Right now, our state law provides that 100% of the premium for an individual or a family plan is paid by the state. Reminder that we've got a blended rate that we use when we pay for that premium, regardless of whether it's a single or a family. We've averaged those out, and the agencies pay the same amount regardless of whether their employee is single or uses the family. The change that would be made in this is that we would still offer the family plan. However, if a state employee opted for the family plan, they would have a financial liability for 15% of the additional cost of that plan over the individual plan. The state would pick up 85% of the difference of the cost of the individual versus the family plan.
Okay, thank you. Then we did reach out to Representative Becker. I did have Levi talk with him, and Representative Becker would just like to relay a few bullet points to us. So Levi, if you could explain what Representative Becker said to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As the chairman mentioned, I did speak with Representative Becker briefly. He regrets that he wouldn't be able to be here today to discuss his bill draft, but he briefly just mentioned that he wanted to convey the primary focus of the bill will be that there's the 15% that state employees would have to pay for the difference between the family and the single plan. However, he also wanted to point out that he believes that the bill would also realize cost savings to the state due to what he had called natural attrition, assuming that employees that have spouses that are able to receive family plans at the spouse's employer may have actually have an opportunity to have a cheaper option, and will thus the state employee will potentially move over to or have their dependents move over to the spouse's plan with their employer, and then the state employee would go to a single plan at the state, thus realizing additional cost savings. So it's he believes it's both the cost savings from the 15%, but also from state employees moving to a single plan and having spouses pick up family plans.
Okay, Representative Laney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a point I'd like to have clarified. My understanding on this bill proposal is that the employee would pay 15% of the difference between the single plan and the, so say for instance there was $100 difference, he would then pay $15. Am I correct?
Thank you. That's my understanding, yes. Okay, Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, Scott Miller, Executive Director, North Dakota PERS. Bill 388, the health insurance contribution requirements. You've already talked a little bit about this. It requires employees who elect family health insurance coverage under the PPO basic plan to pay 15% of the difference between that single and family contract premium. Right now we have a blended. We'd have to split that up, of course. It reduces the state contribution to an HDHP or high deductible health plan participant's health savings account from 100% of the difference between the PPO and high deductible health plan premiums to 85%. From the consultant's perspective, we will save, the state will save nearly $18 million annually in premium payments. It will reduce state contribution to HSA accounts or high or health savings accounts by approximately $80,000 per year. The PPO basic contribution change will end the grandfathered status because that is greater than the 5% that we can charge employees and still maintain the grandfathered plan. What that would actually mean would is that the state would have to move away from the grandfathered plan to the non-grandfathered plan. That would result in an approximately 3% increase in premium amounts, and because of that transfer and the difference in the premiums between the two, that actually tends to erase a lot of that $18 million premium payment savings that the state would receive, at least according to our research person on staff. And that's all that I have for the...
So what you're saying is if this bill were to go from 15% down to 5%, that 3% would no longer be in play?
That's correct. We would save the grandfathered status. It'd still be a grandfathered plan. That's not a change that is large enough to endanger a grandfathered status.
Okay. Any questions from the committee? Senator Beckedahl.
Hey, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Miller. The 5 percentage point, if you did 5 percentage point this session and 5 the next session, cumulatively that would be 10, and that would drop us out of the grandfathered status as well?
That's correct. It is a 5% total.
Okay.
Any other questions? Anyone in the audience like to address the committee? Anyone in the audience like to address the committee? Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Nick Archuleta. I'm the president of North Dakota United, and we represent K-12 teachers, public employees across the state, as well as higher ed. When you consider this particular bill draft, I think it's important to note that you're talking about not just numbers, but as people. And you're talking about a group of people who haven't had a raise in 2 years. Their out-of-pocket expenses for health insurance have gone up naturally. And this then would just be another shot at them, regardless of what the savings are. I am really concerned too that we would lose the grandfathered status. That opens up in another an entirely different set of problems that we're going to have to deal with. So I would encourage a no vote on this, or not to recommend it. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions of Mr. Archuleta? Senator Larson.
Mr. Chairman, did you know what a would you know what an individual that's 50 years old that's not in the state system, what they pay for health insurance out of pocket?
Representative or Chairman LaFleur, Senator Larson, no, I do not. I'm not an actuary.
Thank you.
Any other questions of Mr. Archuleta? Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else like to address the committee? Anyone else? Okay, then we'll go to committee discussion. Or is there a motion? Senator Mathen.
I would move an unfavorable recommendation.
There's a motion for an unfavorable recommendation. Is there a second? Second by Representative Mitzcock. Committee discussion. Senator Dever.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think of employee compensation as in total compensation, and I think if we're asking them to reduce a benefit, it needs to be considered in the context of whatever the compensation salary increase is this year. So I'm going to vote along with the motion, pending that future amendment.
I would agree with that. They have not had a raise for 2 years. And what Senator Dever just said is that, you know, goes down to total employee contribution. And there are sections of public employees where we are trailing the private sector, and we need to be very cognizant of that. And the only argument that I would have would be that at some point in time with employees, paying a percentage of their health insurance utilization has had a tendency to go down. But that's the only argument I'd make for it, but I also intend to vote with the recommendation. Any further questions? Senator Mathen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I believe the plan that we have covering families not only a great recruitment tool for our public systems, but I think it should be the public policy of our state for every plan. We're a family-oriented state. We take care of our families. I think this states the principle, and instead of moving down, we should move up. In fact, there are more places that we should consider the whole family when we make decisions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments? Okay, there is an unfavorable recommendation in front of us. So if you're voting yes, you're voting for an unfavorable recommendation. Jennifer.
Thank you. Representatives LaFleur.
Yes.
Doctor.
Yes.
Kreit.
Yes.
Lanning.
Yes.
Mitzcock. Ruby.
Yes.
Senators Dever.
Yes.
Beckedahl.
Aye.
Revesbaugh. Larson.
No.
Lee.
Aye.
And Mathern.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman, that motion does carry.
Okay. I don't think we have anything else for discussion, do we?
No, just a reminder that we might be meeting again in the future.
Okay. Just a reminder that we may be meeting during the session, but we'll let you know if we do need to meet. So with that, meeting is adjourned.
Great job.
I